Yes, you may proceed.
Thank you so much, Judge. The case today is Stephen Punsky versus the City of Portland et al., appeal number 21-2007. Attorney Bennett, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your argument.
Thank you. My name is Jeffrey Bennett. I'm an attorney in Portland, Maine. I represent the appellant, plaintiff below, Stephen Punsky. This case arises from an incident that occurred on New Year's in 2017. Before that, Stephen Punsky, he is a lifelong resident of Portland, Maine. No criminal history before this event whatsoever. Stephen attended the Portland school system and became a plumber, married his high school sweetheart. They remained married through to New Year's of 2017.
Why is this relevant from the officer's perspective when they're arresting for purposes of the qualified immunity? Because when they go there, I'm sure they don't know his history.
Well, because it's not as dangerous a situation as the officers made it out to be at the depositions. And that goes to whether or not their subjective testimony or whether testimony is reasonable.
Counsel, I join these comments. Could you please get to the issue?
Yes.
The issue is whether qualified immunity was improperly granted. Direct your arguments to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the issue of qualified immunity arose. The court below, in plaintiff appellant's perspective, erred in her determination. The standard is whether or not the officers had a reasonable, objective view that Stephen's constitutional rights were being violated, or alternatively, whether or not the danger was so obvious that a reasonable police officer would have recognized that and acted differently. And that is the alternative standard under Hope v. Pelzer, which is 536 U.S. 730. The court did not address that standard. On the night on an issue, for the 5 days leading up to that night, and this is in the appendix, Portland, Maine was experiencing historic low temperatures. We had an Arctic blast for 5 straight days. The temperatures did not exceed 0 degrees. They were below zero most of the time. On the night in question, there had been multiple
days. Counselor, it was objectively unreasonable for the police to listen to your client, and they offered him shoes on several occasions. They offered him medical assistance, which he refused, and he repeatedly said he was fine.
Well, and Your Honor, that's what I was addressing the background. Stephen had become a victim of the opioid addiction epidemic. And
well, would the police know that?
Yes, they did, because they'd been at the house on a prior occasion. But weeks leading up to this event,
that doesn't mean that they knew about it. What happened on the prior occasion?
What they knew on this night was that Stephen had consumed a bottle of vodka because he was self-medicating, because his opioid medication had been terminated weeks earlier, and he had been hit in the head badly. He had a broken bone in his nose, and he was bleeding from his head when the police wrote when Stephen's son had hit him. So the police knew that they had a person who also was not mentally well, because they had been told that by Stephen's son and wife. So they knew they had an individual who was not well mentally, had consumed a bottle of vodka that night, and had a head injury. And he was in stocking feet, shorts, and they walked him outside after 5 days of historic low temperatures. It literally was Alaska and the state of Maine at this point in time, and had been for a number of days. They placed him on pavement. The pavement was frozen solid like the floor of a freezer. And when it's common knowledge that when you suffer freeze bite or freezer burn, you don't feel it until your limbs start to thaw. So we had a medical professional who was on site, brought by the police. He and the police, they're the ones that are trained. The danger was as obvious as the danger could possibly be under those conditions. They had him out there for 26 minutes exposed to those elements. They weren't exposed to those elements. They were all dressed properly. They had multiple cruiser cars on that street that they could have brought in and put him in. The court below found that Stephen would have fit in a cruiser car, but the officers didn't command him to go into a cruiser car. They didn't command him to do anything. They took him into custody, and they asked him on different occasions, would you like a pair of shoes? He was drunk. He had head wounds. He had a mental health issue. He was in crisis, and he was, and when the paramedic asked him, he acted as if he was engaging in what sometimes is called suicide police type behavior. He had shut down and he was not being responsive or cooperative. So our position is that the police had a duty under the special relationship doctrine, and that duty was to protect Stephen, not simply from the elements, but to protect Stephen from himself. And they failed to do so. And they said point blank to him.
Does your complaint state a special duty?
It does. And the court below found that we adequately pled that claim. We pled the 14th Amendment. And so we did plead it. And we pled it factually as well as legally. And the police did not command him to put on shoes. They simply offered him shoes. And they didn't place him in a cruiser. They didn't command him to get into a cruiser, and they had multiple empty cruisers, all with heat, that they could have placed him in. They had an ambulance on the street, and they didn't command him to get inside the ambulance. When they did give a command, they commanded him when the paddy wagon finally arrived 26 minutes later, and they commanded him to get into the paddy wagon. Perfectly cooperatively, he walked right into the paddy wagon. And what the court below missed, and it's on the audio tape that's Exhibit 1 to the Gibson affidavit, is that Stephen repeatedly asked at least three or more times to be placed in a cruiser, and he was denied that. So the court below found that it wouldn't have been reasonable for the officers to put Stephen in a cruiser because he had been belligerent, was the court's word. He was mouthy, admittedly. But you don't under those conditions, such extreme conditions, emergency conditions. If a person's mouthy, regardless of that.
Okay, but he's mouthy, but he's 6'4", 320, and he's telling him, if you touch me or you arrest me, I don't know what his exact words are in the record, but he's basically telling what's going to happen to him if they arrest him. So don't they have to act reasonably under those circumstances?
When the taser's pointed at him, yes, he was upset about a taser being pointed at him, but he was not like that when the taser was sheathed. Only when the taser was unsheathed. And if you go back and look at the record, it will be clear that only when the tasers were pointed at him did he act in that manner. At other times, he was cooperative, but he wasn't fully understanding. And the court below found that, yes, he was a big man, but the record doesn't reflect that he was a strong man. He was 57 years old. So formally, in high school, he was a big, strong man, but at this stage of his life, he's ailing. He was in pain. Back pain is in the record. He had cancer of the vertebrae.
But how do the officers know that? That's the other thing.
Well,
They
were told. They were told by Stephen before they left the house. They were told by Gwen when they interviewed Gwen, his wife. They were told by his son Mitchell when they interviewed Mitchell. And they could see with their own eyes that this was not a healthy person. So yes, while he was large, and yes, he had a big mouth, there was no physical altercation whatsoever with the police. He cooperated with every command. He just didn't accept the offer of shoes, because he didn't either realize he needed the shoes, or he was acting in a way that was detrimental to himself. And because he was in custody, and because it was such an extreme and dangerous situation in Maine at that time, the police officers had a duty in order to protect Stephen from himself. And they had available means. They had multiple cars that were empty on the street, and an ambulance, a big box ambulance they had available. And they never commanded him to go take safety in one of those vehicles.
Counsel.
Alternatively, they could have had Gwen and Mitchell leave the house, and go into the vehicles, and they could have kept Stephen in the house until the emergency wagon came. It was also a garage on that property. They could have done multiple things under those urgent conditions. They did nothing. They left him standing out there. Now, in the judge's analysis, if this had evolved for 3 minutes or 5 minutes, I could understand that, you know, she concluded that the police officers acted reasonably under the circumstances. But when you start to get to 15 minutes or 18 minutes or 20 minutes or 21 minutes, now the passage of time is such that I submit that the constitutional analysis evolves, and there comes a point in time where any officer, objective or not, would realize that this is dangerous, this man is being exposed to the elements, and an injury is likely to occur. And the police at some point in time had a responsibility to put him in a cruiser, which they did not. And
okay, but how do you constitutionally determine then the threshold? You said 18 minutes perhaps, 16 minutes?
At some point it becomes objectively unreasonable behavior on the part of the police. That's my argument. At some point, at the passage of time, it becomes objectively unreasonable because the passage of time and the exposure to the elements creates the danger, danger well known, that's so obvious anybody could see it.
Okay, and one last question. There's information that the police have that there may be weapons in the residence. So when they go there, they also have that in mind. So doesn't that affect, how does that play into the whole scenario?
It does, and I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to address it. The police had been there on a prior occasion. When Stephen's medication was first cut off, he was suicidal, and Gwen called the police to come remove his weapons from the house. So the police had that information on file, but what they failed to, you know, inform this court us is that the police went to the house to remove the weapons. So they should have known that there were no weapons there because they had already removed the weapons on the prior visit. And that was the purpose for the prior visit. It wasn't that there was an incident.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Bennett. Attorney Wall, please introduce yourself on the record to begin.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is John Wall. I'm appearing on behalf of the defendants in this case. The only issue that's not been waived at this point is the civil rights claims against the officers. The plaintiff has failed to preserve any claims against the city of Portland or the supervisors Malik or Dyer. And the plaintiff also waived the discretionary function of immunity issue under the Major Claims Act by failing to address it below before the district court. We've suggested numerous grounds for alternative grounds for the court to affirm the summary judgment that district court granted. But unquestionably, the court's analysis of the qualified immunity question was correct. The plaintiff's assignments of error in this case are unfounded, as you can observe from the district court's decision. The district court gave the plaintiff every benefit of the doubt with regard to not only the pleadings, but also the record on summary judgment. The court assumed that a special relationship claim had been pled, even though that allegation of special relationship doesn't appear in the complaint, nor does that theory appear in the counts themselves. The court also made every assumption with regard to the issues in the record, many of which the plaintiff has discussed here today. And the court assumed that the right has been clearly established. The second prong of the summary judgment analysis, of the qualified immunity analysis, that the clarity of the right had been established. So the issue that the plaintiff raised with regard to Holt versus Pelzer is something that the district court assumed and simply focused its analysis on the second portion of the clearly established prong, the objective reasonableness of the officer's conduct. And under the circumstances, as the district court noted, circumstances clearly supported the officer's assessment of the events occurring before them in terms of the risk presented by Mr. Punsky. And their actions were guided by.
But why would an objective officer believe that, given the elements, that Mr. Punsky wouldn't be harmed by being on that sidewalk with no shoes and with shorts on?
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay.
Obviously, from the perspective of the right we're talking about, it's the question of whether or not the officers would know that they were preventing the plaintiff from protecting himself. And under that standard, I think the officers were justified in understanding that they gave him every opportunity to protect himself, and he simply refused to help himself in that regard. They obviously had to take into consideration the safety issues presented by the plaintiff, his erratic behavior and his size.
Was he in custody at that point?
During a portion of the time, he was in custody, yes.
So when he was in police custody, why wouldn't the police be compelled to make sure, not just that he protected himself, but that they adequately didn't cause harm to him?
And I think that the standard we're looking at was a focus on not just the protection of the arrestee, but also the protection of the officers and the other persons involved in the situation. So they had to take those all into consideration and make sure that he had an opportunity to protect himself, which they certainly did under the circumstances. They gave him numerous opportunities to put footwear on, actually bringing footwear to him to place on his feet. He consistently refused.
But why didn't they have an affirmative obligation to protect him?
Well, I think under the Cheney language that this court has referenced in this case in regard, the focus is whether or not they prevented him from protecting himself. And that, as I understand it, is the standard they need to be objectively reasonable with regard. And in the circumstances of this case, they certainly, a reasonable officer could believe that they met that requirement by, as I say, giving him multiple opportunities to protect himself, by putting footwear on, by providing him with a medical evaluation on site shortly after being taken outside. He was non-compliant with the paramedic. The paramedic was able to evaluate him, determine that he seemed in control of his faculties, understanding what's going on. The paramedic offered to take him to the ambulance for an evaluation, and he declined that. And the paramedic officer didn't assess him in a situation where the circumstances, he was incapable of protecting himself. And so I think under the standard that the reasonable officer would be applying, the circumstances, the police gave him every opportunity to protect himself. Okay. And the alternatives that the plaintiff has suggested in terms of taking him back into the house or putting him in a vehicle, the district court clearly addressed those type of issues. The safety considerations in terms of trying to get him into a vehicle was something that the officers were allowed to take into consideration. The safety issues to the complainant, the victim in the house was something that they were allowed to take into consideration, required to take into consideration. And the fact that it's undisputed in the record that they would have had to complete a sweep of the house to deal with the weapons issue, but also with regard to any of the risks that may be presented coming back in the house, and that would have taken enough time so that the transport van would have been there around the same time. So they took everything into consideration as they're required to in these circumstances and determined that their attempts to try and help him would be objectively reasonable under those circumstances.
Yeah. Counsel Bennett mentioned that he was reactive to the officers only when they pulled out their tasers. Could you address that in the whole scenario?
Yes. Well, obviously, the district court and this court has the benefit of video and audio evidence, which obviously can't be contradicted by the plaintiff's contrary type of assertions. That video and audio evidence clearly establishes that the reason the officers had to remove him from the house in the first place was his own aggressive behavior, argumentative behavior, and threatening behavior, and that once they got him outside, admittedly, he was not combative the entire time he was outside, but there were various instances when he was outside that they were communicating with him, and he was aggressive, combative, verbally, and aggressive, and threatening.
So your client's position is getting at least not using the taser, but showing the tasers or having readily available, that does not affect the analysis at all. It's part of what the officer is doing to protect themselves, correct?
Absolutely. And under the circumstances, it was certainly one of the tools that the officers had to try and avoid any kind of physical altercation, which obviously was the desire of the officers all along, was to try and control the situation and to provide safety not only for the victims but themselves in terms of dealing with Mr. Punsky, and that their offers of assistance to him, both in terms of getting footwear but also in terms of providing medical services, was their effort to try and help him protect himself in these circumstances. Unless the board has any additional questions, thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.